we keep allowing these people to be over here. We keep allowing them to have official statuses, to have a means of creating finances within this country, right? And that's how they keep their operations. Their recruitment center, right? Their whole recruitment is from the West now.
Coming up on British Thought Leaders, writer and commentator Momus Najmi talks about Britain's Islamist problem.
The more that the Islamists are trying to push their agenda, the Muslims are going start getting disconnected within, because the normal Muslim population is not that political, right? As long as their needs are being met.
And why the recent focus on Islamophobia is not helping.
It enables Islamists and jihadis and other extreme point of views, even conservative Muslims' point of views, which are extremist. It helps them hide behind it. It's sort of like an anti-racist cloak shield that they have created.
Welcome to British Thought Leaders. I'm Lee Hall. Today I'm sitting down with writer and podcaster Momus Najmi. Momus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Can you start by telling us a bit about your journey and how you got to where you are today?
If I start from the beginning, not since the Land of Dinosaurs, but a bit after that. I was born in Kuwait in the Middle East. I was 4 years old when the Gulf War happened, so I saw that as well. I moved to Pakistan when I was 15-ish, around that time. It's around that time that I started leaving Islam as well. And then I came to Britain in 2010. So since then I've been here, and now a British citizen as well. So that has been my geographical journey, sort of a thing. And my ideological journey has been that of being born in a Muslim family, but not a very conservative Muslim family, a pretty liberal Muslim family. And in Kuwait, you don't really have that much of a conservative Islam as such. You have a pretty loosely, you know, held Islam over there. But some people are conservative, some people are liberal. They just let everyone be. My shocking experience was when I moved to Pakistan to see how dogmatic some people were. And, you know, that made me investigate deeper into the religion. And it took me 6 years, and after 6 years, I decided that it wasn't to my liking, and so I left. And I had a lot of problems, so then I had to leave. And I would say, like, my political side of it, if that journey that we want to map, I've always been a centrist. You know, it doesn't make sense to me to take sides too much. But these days, I guess I would be considered right wing or even far right by some people, just because I love this country.
So you were brought up in one of the richest countries in the world. You could have gone there, or you could have gone to other places such as America. I mean, why did you choose Britain? What is it about Britain that you like?
When I was in Kuwait, I always wanted to, I associated more with Britain than any other country. So I always felt homeless geographically as well. So I was born in a country which doesn't want you, really. You know, it's not giving you nationality. It doesn't want you to integrate. It doesn't care about you in that sense. But culturally, when I went to Pakistan, I couldn't assimilate with them. So I was homeless in that sense. And Britain has always been something that has attracted me since I was a kid. I like the history, even though people say, like, about colonization and whatnot. I didn't mind that part that much, to be honest, because I admired them for a lot of things that had been done. So I was looking at it from afar, and I was consuming the culture, the literature, since I was young. So it was something that was eventually going to happen. And when push came to shove, and I had to move out of Pakistan because it just became unviable to live in that country for my own safety, so I had to choose Britain.
Cause I mean, celebrating British values is kind of laughed at to some degree, or even considered a bit offensive these days. I mean, why do you think that is, and do you think it's harmful?
It's very harmful. A nation is not a nation unless its people know itself, right? So if the people are rejecting themselves, it's not a nation then. And that's what Britain has become now. or is becoming. It's becoming more of an international refugee center rather than a nation, because there are people who are unaware of their own identity and are rejecting it, or, you know, ashamed of accepting it, which I find odd. I think so it's bizarre that people are being made to feel as if their values are not as important, or actually, in my opinion, more important than the rest of the world. You know, and you have to think like that, because every other country thinks like that. Mm. Even if their own values and culture are not the best in the world, they'll still think they are. So I'm not sure. I think so it comes from, like I said, it comes from people not knowing themselves, and also people who are in positions of influence not reinforcing the idea of being British, because they have this sort of guilt in them. It's an unearned sort of guilt that they have, you know, just associating some sort of guilt from the past, you know, not even knowing their own history properly. You know, it just comes from those sort of things. And I think it's detrimental for the whole nation.
Looking at the situation in Gaza, it's really affected what's happening in Britain. We've seen a lot of unprecedented things here, the mass protests, obviously, but also politicians giving up hundreds of years of tradition because they're scared, you know, anti-Semitic slogans projected onto Parliament. I mean, there's a lot of abuses happening in the world. There's a million Uyghur Muslims in concentration camps in China. Why is it this Gaza issue that can really rile people up to such a degree?
I was saying that there is trouble brewing 1 or 2 months before, that we have a number of Islamist people over here who are riling people up. And if something were to happen, they would activate themselves. You know, you just had a feeling the way they were talking, because as an ex-Muslim, I see commentaries by between ex-Muslims and Islamists, and like, you know, their like their discussions and stuff between them, and you can feel from how brave the Islamists are being within the West that what is brewing behind it, what is making them that strong, sort of a thing. Mostly, the Gaza problem would have been the communist elements in the country acting up. But because of their activity, the Islamists, and they've seen an ally, both of them, in themselves, that has become a bit more troublesome, I think so.
Right.
Their combination of it. So there you have two extremist sort of element within Islam. It's the jihadis who don't like the Islamist tactics. They want to just go and blow themselves up, or like just do a war and stuff like that. And then there's the Islamist element, which think that what we need to do is politically subvert the West, right? And that's where they're working. So I think so there are a lot of elements that are working within this country and other countries as well in the West that are just opposed to the existence of Britain, right? It's not about Gaza. It's an opportunity to take hold of Britain in one way or another, have their influence. And that's what you see in all elements. That's what you see in the extremist elements that are within Labour Party as well, extremist elements within Liberal Democrats and all the other party who might be Islamist or who might be communist, you know, Marxist, whatever iterations that they are of them. You know, they latch on to any topic which is anti, which supports the anti-British sentiments. It doesn't even matter what it is. So even though in Gaza we saw these terrorists commit such horrible atrocities, they're willing to forego them, right? They'll make excuses for them because it makes them, you know, it achieves their target of taking over eventually. That's what they want.
It's really interesting that you're bringing up the connection between the communism and Islamism.
Mm.
I mean, if we look at Sayyid Qutb, who founded Islamism, he was described as the Karl Marx of radical Islam.
Yeah.
In the struggle, the fight against the traditions and things like that, the two mesh together quite well. Can you talk a bit more about the connection between the two as you see it?
So, I'll tell you about the connection between the what I have observed, at least the connection between Pakistan and communism as well, because there used to be communist parties within Pakistan, which before Islamization, which is not Islamism, the Islamization of Pakistan, that sort of took that away, the communist elements. But Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the founder of Pakistan, he was Marxist, right? If you read any of his speeches or any of his thoughts and stuff like that, they indicate that he was Marxist and he wanted to create sort of a combination of Islam and socialism within Pakistan. And that's why he had Pakistan, right? That was his idea from the start. He died within a year of Pakistan being independent. So that didn't come to fruition. But there were other people who took that baton and like they went on with it, right? And further on in the 1970s, there was a Prime Minister, Bhutto, who was from the People's Party of Pakistan, which is a socialist party, or supposed to be. And he took over and he started nationalizing everything. So first he started with like good things, as all socialists and communists do, and they started helping everyone. He started getting a lot of support, like, oh yeah, it's helping us. Then all of a sudden he said, he's going to nationalize everything. He's going to nationalize the rail. He's going to nationalize everything in the country, right? And then there was a General Ziaul-Haq. He was the same general who fought in Jordan against the Marxist Palestinians of Yasser Arafat, because Palestinians at that time attacked Jordan in the 70s, I think, so it was 70s. And he was fighting against them, right? And he went against the orders and stuff, and he just, like, you know, went ahead anyways in one of the battles or whatever. When he came back, he was, after a while, he was made the army chief. And when Bhutto started nationalizing everything, he declared martial law. He took over, he put him in jail, and then eventually he hung him, right? So that shows me that there was heavy involvement between the Islamists and communists without even Islamism even being invented.
We're seeing some evidence of this connection again in Rochdale. Yeah. George Galloway just won the by-election in an openly socialist party, Workers' Party of Britain.
And that's the thing, if you see with Galloway as well, you know, I would say he's more of a communist than he's a socialist, but he's an opportunist. It's not really about him. It shows us that we can beat the two major parties if we are more organized. It just so happens that the left is more organized. The far left is far more organized than anyone else because they're determined. People are saying he's not communist because he's anti-woke. Well, you know what? Like, he's an old school communist. So he will say he's socialist. How do we know? We can't trust this guy, which is what I see as a dark moment for Britain, that I see people on every side supporting him just because he's against the establishment, right? And I'm like, well, the enemy of my enemy is actually not my friend, you know. And we've seen that, we played that out in Second World War as well recently, which is the recent example. And Soviet Union did not end up being our friend, you know. It's always the case. It's like, yeah, you can use them for a while, but you know, you have to depend on your morals. If you're going on your principles, on your morals and stuff, you'll only do that when you are aware of yourself, when you're knowing of yourself. Then you can say, no, I'll take the hit, but I'll do the right thing. You know, that's how you root out evil from your society. And people are cheering for him just because he's given a blow to both Tories and both Labour, right? Which we can see as an opportunity for everyone, that look, if we are more organized and we put our best foot forward, then it can happen. Also, around 10 or so thousand, like, people could have voted, they haven't voted, or even more people, they didn't vote, you know. So if those people came out, then Galloway would not have won as well. So it's sort of like those sort of, what he's telling us basically in his deceit is there's an opportunity for people who actually care for the country to come up. But for me, what it's telling is I feel a bit disjointed with this, like there's a problem within our society where people just don't know what they're fighting, right? And everyone is just going after each other. They only know what they're fighting against, but they don't know what they're fighting for because they don't know themselves.
I think a classic example of what you're saying is someone who's holding a Queers for Palestine sign, and it's like they don't understand that if you were gay in that country, you would face consequences. It's like people don't really know what they're fighting for anymore. They just latch onto a cause.
Because they don't know themselves, you know? They don't know. This is what liberalism has done to us, I feel. And I've been feeling for a while, and I've been a classical liberal, tendency towards classical liberalism all my life. But I can see when it's good to be liberal in certain circumstances, especially in peaceful times. But, you know, when push comes to shove, it's like, are you going to suspend your ideas for a little while, where you can conserve the liberal society that you have, right? But I don't see that anymore. I see as the conservatives are liberals themselves. The conservatives are conserving liberalism, right? While on the other side, the people who are supposed to be liberal, they're taking their clothes off, they're running stark naked in the field. Like, they've gone beyond that, right? While the other side is still, like, holding on to liberalism as well. And there's no actual, you know, something against them. There's no actual opposition towards liberalism to keep liberalism in check, which used to be conservatism, you know? And I think so it's also because we have moved towards materialistic society so much, you know? We didn't just lose God. I think so, we just lost ourselves, right? So even when we had a society that, you know, after Enlightenment, where people might or might not have believed in God as much as before, people were knowing of themselves. People didn't lose themselves. People didn't become so materialistic, right? They understood the importance of human connections. They understood the connection that they had with their lands, with their fellow citizens, right? The human elements of it. Mm-hmm. And with their nation, they had strong roots with their nation, whether they believed in a God or not. Right, there was some hierarchy because there were still a lot of people who believed, and they were surrounded, but they were cocooned by that belief. Right, so when we lost God, we lost ourselves because we had no relevance to the world, and we said, well, we're all atoms, aren't we? So, and we're all going to die, and there's nothing after life. So, do whatever you like. Well, if you're going by that, then fine, then we shouldn't be complaining about Islamists or Islam or communists or anything, because they're doing what they want. Why shouldn't, this is the problem with liberalism. It's like, well, why shouldn't they be allowed to think like they want to think? Everyone is allowed to think what they want, right? It's like, well, you know, it's not conducive to your existence. You're arguing against your existence because you've lost a relevance of your existence that has existed for a very long time. Now, if you wanted to leave religion, like, I'm not religious, I'm agnostic, but I think if you remove something, you have to replace it with something stronger, right? Not with something equal, not with something, some sort of idea. It has to be something a lot more stronger than what you're replacing, because that thing has been there for a very, very long time. Even if it was a weak idea, it has become really strong over the course of time. Now, when you remove that, it has to be something really strong to replace it, to replace all its mileage along with the idea itself. And we didn't do that. There was nothing to replace religion.
You know, Nigel Farage said that by 2029, there'd be a serious Islamist force in Parliament. What are your thoughts on that?
Could be next year, it could be 2029. I think so. It could not be at all, right? Because it depends on the population. I think so. He's saying, according to the population, because their population are growing of the Muslims, that they would do that, right? That's dependent on how far the Islamists are going to push their agenda. Because the more that the Islamists are trying to push their agenda, the Muslims are going start getting disconnected with it. Because the normal Muslim population is not that political, right? As long as their needs are being met, right? So if we put a stop to immigration now, and we say, like, we do a Trump style, these are the Muslim countries we're not having immigration from. And it's a sensible thing to do because you get most troubles from those countries, right? Just stop it from there. So if we do that, then the pipeline of the extremism that is coming through is going to be blocked. And it will give the chance for people over here to become more moderate as they used to be before the Muslim population, since we started getting a lot of people in the 90s and so on, right? And also it has to be met with deportations, right? So I think so he's saying it because he doesn't see that happening, right? So that makes me more nervous if he doesn't see that happening. It's like, well, you were supposed to bring it, right? Why have you squandered your opportunity? Why have you not come into politics yet? You know, he should have been re-entered at least in January, but he's still waiting, right? And now people are getting frustrated with Faraj as well, because they're like, well, as far as I see it, that what are you waiting for? Are you just for your personal gains? And because this is what people are saying, like, or are you just going to come when it's easy for you to come? Or are you actually going to fight with us? So I think so he's saying things as a political commentator now rather than a politician. If it was a politician, it would be a different idea that he's giving. But he's right to point out anyways, if we don't take the necessary steps now, then it's likely that will happen.
Looking at Islamism a bit more, I mean, Islamists, they want this transnational caliphate under the Sharia law. And Gulf states like the one you were brought up in, they won't accept this kind of extremism. But it seems here in Britain we have this kind of head-in-the-sand attitude towards it, and we do. Do you think we've allowed this kind of civil war that's happening in the Muslim world to be imported into our country?
Yeah. If we wouldn't have these people, if we had low immigration from all these countries and we deported anyone who was extremist, we deported everyone who went to fight for or wanted to fight for ISIS a while back. Even at least if you took actions back then, I was like, no, all of them deport. Don't care if you live, if you were born over here or not, if you have a dual nationality, deport. Or comes to it, your option, choose exile or choose prison. That's for life, you know. If we remove them, remove these elements way before, Hezbollah would not be here. Hamas would not be here, ISIS would not be here, and Al-Qaeda would not be here, Taliban would not be here. Because they would not have the support. They don't have the support from their Muslim countries. And that's the thing. They don't have the support of moderate Pakistanis even. Right? They have the support of fanatical extremist Pakistanis. And their intelligence section of Pakistan is playing in these games as well. They would have the support of Iran at most, but Iran is a pariah state unless it gets the support from Russia and other sources, right? Qatar would not be doing what they're doing if we just ban. It's like, okay, we take all your investment away from here. We don't want you to do the same thing that we did with Russians to them. But we keep allowing these people to be over here. We keep allowing them to have official statuses, to have a means of creating finances within this country, right? And that's how they keep their operations. Their recruitment center, right? Their whole recruitment is from the West now. Is the Muslims from the West, that those are the ones that they're recruiting, right? Look at Finland. Finland is a hub for them because these refugees are going from Iraq and Syria. They're going to Finland to live over there, and they're actually being radicalized over there as well, you know, because they have Islamist mosques and stuff. You know, they would not have the same infrastructure within Dubai, within Saudi Arabia, within Kuwait, because they would kick them out. Now, that's not to say that all these moderate Muslim countries are our friends. We still should not consider them our friends or allies and stuff. It's just people that we do business with, because ultimately the coding is still there with them. They're still diametrically opposed. And if given the chance, they will conquer, right? It's just that they're not interested at the moment. They're more interested in their prosperity and stuff, which is good for us. That's what we should play on. They have kicked those people out, these people out, for that reason. You know, and they're very thorough with their investigation from Jordan, from Saudi Arabia and all these places.
Even you mentioned the moderate Muslim countries, but even France, if imams are preaching hate, they're booted out.
Yeah.
Why is Britain so different? Something about the British character?
I think so. They just don't know. I think so. Like in France, we might see that, oh, it's a good thing that they're kicking people out, right? But for every one person that they kick out, they have a million others over there. I think so. There's far more extremism in France, and it's being played out on their streets more. That's why they're able to take these actions. Now, it's only recently been playing out on our streets. And it's not that aggressive as well, I would say. Like, you know, it's aggressive, but mainly it's only few people who are doing it, right? We haven't come to that point where people are being beaten up on the streets, like severely, or people getting killed, or like, you know, by Islamists, by jihadis, right? I think so they are at that point. It's not just with jihadis, but it's also with the African import that they have over there, that it's just not getting along. So they can take these actions. But I think so they have it far worse. They have it far worse. And because we don't have it far worse yet, or haven't had for a very long time, it has been swept under the carpet. The support has not been there within the British politicians or the public. And we can see now the British politicians changing a bit. We can see now some of the Tories who are actually conservative being more open about it.
The Prime Minister made his speech and talked about extremism trying to undermine democracy. I mean, do you think that's any kind of turning point?
No. I think so. He just words, and he had to mention far right in there. I tweeted as well about is like, what is this far right of the Christmas past that we keep on talking about? Like this ghost that we keep on talking about, you know, it's not, we don't have a problem with the far right. There is a very small minority of far right. Like since he's been prime minister in the short period, he's shown that he's not interested in what matters to the people. He has his liberal agendas that he wants to push out, and then he keeps on just pushing them. I'm not saying he's a bad person. I'm not saying he's a hard worker. He's probably working his socks off, but it's just like he's not connected with the public. You know, we having Islamist issues, and he's talking about the cigarette bans, the smartphone bans, this bans. It's like nobody cares right now. Nobody cares. You know, it's the house is burning, and you're caring about like, oh, maybe we should put a picture on that. Like, you know, this kind of picture would be nice, and those kind of pictures, but he said they're all burning. It doesn't matter, you know. And we've come to that point. And I think so his speech is the reason, the mere reason that he had to balance it, even though we have had no huge concerns with far right, maybe a lone problem here or there, right? It's not an organized problem, right? That's what people need to understand. Whenever they say, okay, but the far right had these crimes and whatever, they are lone issues. They're not organized issues. But if you keep talking about it, if you keep pushing people, if you keep denying the actual dangers, you will create a far right then. And that far right is going to be ethno-nationalist. You know, that's where it's going to head towards. If we keep on not articulating people's frustrations appropriately, you know, and that's what he keeps on doing. He keeps on not articulating the frustrations appropriately, Rishi Sunak. He had to balance it out. He can't just say Islamist. He had to put in the far right, right? He had to go in the parliament and say, oh, nobody on this aisle supports Tommy Robinson and stuff. Like, why do you even have to recognize that? You know, if you don't want to associate with it, just don't recognize it, right? His comments and stuff, Starmer's comments, just disregard them. Just say, like, you know, nobody on our side, you know, supports any sort of extremist point of views or whatever, if you want to say. But the fact that he wants to distance himself so much with the actual frustrations of the people and label them as far right shows how disconnected he is, and shows that he will not take the necessary steps. He can't take the necessary steps if he's not even able to point out the problems.
Suelo Braverman said that the Islamists are now in charge in Britain. But if we look at the media, there's not really many stories about Islamist threats, but there's a lot of stories about Islamophobia. In obviously, anti-Muslim prejudice is a real thing, but we have laws already to deal with religious hatred, etc. But why is this term is being weaponized so much?
It has always been. Islamophobia is a fake term that has been created for a very long time. It enables Islamists and jihadis and other extreme point of views, even conservative Muslims' point of views, which are extremist. It helps them hide behind it. It's sort of like an anti-racist cloak shield that they have created. I would say, like, up to a point, anti-Muslim is sort of like, even anti-Muslim itself is sort of like, yeah, well, you would be, right? If you believe in Christianity, you're naturally anti-Muslim in that sense. Not the person, but the person believing in those things, right? And wanting to exercise their things. So if you have this society and a Muslim comes in, not Islamist, not jihadist or whatever, but they want to have four wives, right? And you say, well, that's not allowed over here. So we don't do polygamy, so you're not allowed to do it. Your laws are then anti-Muslim, right? Because that Muslim is unable to exercise their religious right, right? So even then, I don't agree with the anti-Muslim being a valid term and stuff. These are things that are, again, they are diametrically opposed to the Western ideology. You know, our cultures and our values, it is diametrically opposed to it. The more that you keep on accepting it as just cultural cliches in that society, the more you keep on normalizing it, and the more that you keep on having to adjust in your laws for them, right? And the more that you adjust, the more that you dilute your own laws then. And that's the problem with Islamophobia that I have, right? That it shouldn't exist. It's not like anti-Semitic, right? It's not anti-Semitism, because anti-Semitism is against Semites, like it's an actual ethnic groups, like, you know, and those are different sort of tropes. If I criticize Judaism, no Jew is going to come out and want to kill me, you know, at least that I know of. I'm not going to get death threats. Right? So I think Suelo Braverman is right in saying, like, we have a problem. Not like there are a few others within Tory party who are brave enough, but she's the one who can see the dangers very clearly, because I think so, because her husband is Jew, she knows the hatred that comes from a certain group of people against Jewish people. So I think so, she understands the dangers a lot more than other people, because she understands it not on a factual basis, because on factual basis we can muddy the data and we can prop up log, yeah, but like these lone far-right people, we have problems with them and stuff. Like, you know, we can up and down the data. Most Muslims don't do it and stuff. She understands on a very emotional level, I think so.
I mean, Labour have adopted a definition of Islamophobia as a type of racism that targets expressions of Muslimness and perceived Muslimness. There's quite a lot to consider there, but...
Anything. That's me.
Well, but I mean, why, for a start, are they considering Islam as racism, Islamophobia as racism, when, you know, people of any race could be a Muslim?
They don't consider it. It's just a tactic. Starmer has a problem within his party. He has Marxist and he has Islamist, right? And those are strong elements. Now, he thought like, oh, I'll just get rid of Jeremy Corbyn and I can get rid of one side of, say, no, you can't. Because your grassroots have that problem. It's not your just your MPs and stuff. He's trying to appease both of them, you know, and while trying to get rid of some elements who come up as obvious, right? I think so. It's just a policy that is put out because he's scared of losing the Muslim votes, which goes to show the level of politics that we have, that we want to appease an out-group, and it is an out-group. It is not an in-group. It doesn't matter if you're born in a country. It doesn't give you the right to belong to that country, just being born in a country, right? If you're going to be diametrically opposed ideologically to that country's existence, you're never going to be an in-group. Now, it's not all of them, but surely people who are Marxist, who are even like born over here for generations and generations, they made themselves an out-group. And the only way that they can be an in-group is when their ideology takes over. And then they make the far-right people out-group in that sense, right? Because they would be, it would not be the normal for them then. And I think so, that's all it is. He's scared of losing the Muslim votes and he's like, okay, we'll do this. Islamophobia thing is going to be a huge win. People on our side don't criticize Islam anyways, right? And people on their side do it. That's a way of us catching them. But what he's not thinking is that you're putting something or you're trying to put something in the law that is going to catch all of you. And they're going to use this more and more and more. And how we've seen, like how all of a sudden, all these so-called moderate Muslims have come about and started crying about Islamophobia after Suella Braverman's comments and after Lee Anderson's comments, right? All of a sudden, it's like, so where were you guys when a lot of your people were chanting from the river to the sea on our streets, right? Were being clearly anti-Semitic, were actually calling for the death of the Jews, right? Where were you people when the Batley Grammar school teacher was hounded out and is still in hiding, right? But now all of a sudden, Islamophobia is a problem. All of a sudden. It's like, you are the thugs. You have been pushing people, right? You've been demonizing people. You have been unwilling to assimilate, right? The only religious group that is just unwilling to coexist with the others. And when people rightfully push you, you're like, oh, Islamophobic. It's just that. It's like the day after or on the day of 7th of October, like just the day after the attack, they are on the streets and celebrating. It's like, so if I criticize them, then I'm Islamophobic. People need to wake up from the dangers of labor. But I don't think so people will, because people just say like, well, you know, I don't, this is the thing, what the Labour Party is thinking is what the members also would be thinking. It's like, well, why would you criticize Islam? It's their religions, like they keep it to themselves and stuff. It's like, because they don't live in those areas, you know. They don't live in those areas where they keep it to themselves so much that you can't go in their areas, right? The areas where I can't go, knowingly that I am not a Muslim, right? The areas like that, was it within Bradford somewhere? Probably somewhere. This guy who converted to Christianity, right? He was a Muslim and he converted to Christianity. He's been given so many death threats. He's being hounded out. He was beaten up to the point that he would have died. He hit his head on the curb and stuff because they beat him up. They put hits on him. You know, they terrorized his family and stuff and everything. And nobody's helping him. Nobody's helping him, right? It's like, so there's a problem with Islamophobia, or is there a problem with these thugs who are using their religion to impose on other people?
When Labour get in, this definition could become law.
Yeah.
And the phrase targeting expressions of Muslimness is such a loose, wide term. I mean, it could mean, if you criticise Sharia law being introduced in the UK, or you criticise the wearing of the burqa in the public, our basic kind of freedom of speech would be under threat from this, surely.
If Labour comes in, it's going to be more troublesome for the moderate Muslims. And that's why I've been poking them to, like, guys, you need to speak up against Islamists, you know, and stop being so anti-British and stuff, you know, or just being silent. Because if you criticize anything, right, it's going to be a problem, right? When your woman want to be moderate and stuff like that, and they're within a family that might become more dogmatic religiously, she would not have a way to complain. Because if she tries to complain, they're like, well, this the policies, the, like the government, the authorities and stuff, they're being Islamophobic or whatever. And that's why, having Islamophobia in the law is going to be a huge problem. It's going to be a problem for all the ex-Muslims, you know, because the moment we criticize, it's not just like you're fearing for your death, right? What you're fearing for is your financial death, right? Because Islamophobia laws and whatever, they can fire you then straight away. It's easier for companies to fire you then. You don't have a job. Nobody's going to hire you if you're known to be something like that. Mm. It's sort of like being labeled as Hitler, isn't it? Like, or a Nazi, whereas you're actually anti-Nazi by being Islamophobic in that sense. But that's what's going to happen. And it's going to frustrate a lot of people. A lot of people are just going to leave the country. And then you're going to be... The problem with that is, we have been saying that, a lot of people have been saying that, like, there's nothing for the young people in this country and they should leave. A lot of people can't leave, right? And when the brightest minds leave, then you're left with extremists taking hold more and more. They gain more and more ground, you know? And then the government keeps on justifying, it's like, we don't have people, so we have to immigrate, like, have immigration, more and more immigration, because that's the only solution they have. They're never going to homegrown, like, you know, train the homegrown people. That's all the only solution, get more people in. And they have no metric of the people that they're getting in. Even America has some standards. We have nothing. We're just getting everyone in. And if we replace the society, then, you know, it's not just a matter of Islamophobia then. The point is not just the term. I might be overplaying it, like, with my rhetoric. But what I'm trying to say is that it gives the indication of where the conversation is going. Because people are going to lose hope. Because if you put that in the law, then people are certain that you prefer the out-group over the in-group. They're like, what's the point? What am I fighting against? The only thing is, like, okay, then I fight on the streets. And then what? The police is already, you know, two-tier policing anyways. Right? We see... Just now, that one of the persons who was putting out stickers and stuff like that, labeled as, like, far right, sentenced to 2 years, right? And on the other hand, you have video evidence of imams in the mosque who are giving hate speeches. Nothing done to them, right? We prescribe Hizb ut-Tahrir as terrorist group. But what happens to their members and their leaders? Nothing. I don't understand this. I don't know if you understand this. I don't understand this, that you're saying this group is terrorist, right? Well, is the group... What is the group? The group is the people, right? If the group is being terrorist, that means the people are being terrorist in that group, right? So why are you not doing anything against the people?
Yeah. Oh, so Marjorie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.